Chapter 8, Achieving Continuity of Consciousness. Human life unfolds in three alternating states. These are the waking state, the state of dream sleep, and the state of deep, dreamless sleep. To better understand how a person may attain deeper insights into the spiritual world, we must therefore form some idea of the changes that occur for those seeking such knowledge in each of these states. Before we undertake the training required to attain such insights, our consciousness is continually broken by periods of sleep. During these intervals, our soul knows nothing either of the outer world or of itself. At certain moments, however, dreams, related either to events in the outside world or to the condition of our own body, rise up out of the ocean of unconsciousness. Normally, we consider such dreams as simply a particular manifestation of sleep, and hence generally distinguish only two states of consciousness, sleeping and waking. In occult science, however, the dream state has a separate significance, independent of the other two states. The previous chapter described the changes that occur in our dream life when we undertake the ascent to higher knowledge. Our dreams lose their meaningless, disorderly, and disconnected character and begin to form an increasingly regular, lawful, and coherent world. As we evolve further, this new dream-born world not only becomes the equal of outer sensory reality with regard to inner truth, but also reveals facts depicting, in the full sense of the word, a higher reality. The sensory world conceals mysteries and riddles everywhere around us. At the same time, it reveals the effects of certain higher realities in it. But as long as our perception is limited to our senses, we cannot penetrate to the causes of these effects. These causes are partially revealed to us in the state that develops out of our dream life, a state that by no means remains static. Of course, we cannot consider these revelations to be real knowledge until we see the same things during our ordinary waking life. But with time and practice, this too occurs. That is, we evolve inwardly to the point of being able to transfer into waking consciousness the state we first formed out of our dream life. This enriches the sense world with something quite new. It is as if we were born blind and were to undergo a successful operation. We would find the world enriched by what our eyes then saw. It is the same when we become clairvoyant in the manner described above. We see the whole surrounding world filled with new qualities, new things, new beings, and so forth. Then we need no longer wait for dreams to live in another world. Now we can transpose ourselves into the state for higher perception whenever it is appropriate. In fact, this state now becomes as important to us as our active perceptions are in ordinary life when compared to what we perceive passively. Thus, it may truly be said that, as students of the occult, we open the sense organs of the soul and behold things that must remain hidden from the physical senses. This state, however, is only a transition to still higher stages of knowledge. For in due course, as we continue the practice of the exercises connected with our training, we find that the radical changes described above are not limited to dream life, but that this transformation in fact extends to what we had before considered the state of deep, dreamless sleep. At first we notice only that the complete unconsciousness that usually accompanies the state of deep sleep is occasionally interrupted by isolated conscious experiences. That is, out of the universal darkness of sleep, perceptions of a previously unknown kind now emerge. To describe these experiences is not easy. Our languages were designed for the material world and contain words that only approximate things not belonging to this world. Nevertheless, for the time being, we must use words to describe the higher worlds. But we can do so only if we make free use of analogy in much of what we say. We can do this because everything in the universe is related to everything else. Indeed, the things and beings of the higher and material world are sufficiently related so that, with a little goodwill, we can obtain a conception of the higher worlds through words intended for the material world. But we must always be conscious of the fact that a great part of such descriptions of the supersensible worlds must inevitably consist of analogies and symbols. Only a part of esoteric training itself, therefore, uses ordinary language. For the rest, we learn a symbolic mode of expression that results naturally from our ascent into higher worlds. We acquire this language for ourselves during the course of our training. This does not mean, however, that we cannot experience something of the nature of the higher worlds from the exoteric descriptions given here. The conscious and at first isolated experiences that emerge from the ocean of unconsciousness in deep sleep are best understood as a kind of hearing. One may describe them as perceptible tones and words. Just as, in comparison to ordinary sense experience, we may describe what happens in dream sleep as a kind of seeing, so we may compare what occurs in deep sleep to impressions received by the ears. Incidentally, we may remark that in the spiritual world, seeing is the higher of the two faculties. In the spiritual world, colors are higher than sounds and words. But what the student first perceives of this world as a result of esoteric training are not the higher colors, but the lower sounds. It is only because our general development has already prepared us for the world revealed in dream sleep that we immediately see colors. We are less prepared for the revealing of the higher world in deep sleep. Therefore, at first, this world reveals itself only in sounds and words, and only thereafter does one ascend to colors and forms. Once we notice such deep sleep experiences, our main task is to make them as clear and vivid as possible. At first this will be very difficult, for we have only an extremely faint experience of what we perceive during this state. Thus, upon awakening, we may know that we have had certain experiences, but what these were remains still quite unclear. The most important thing at this early stage is to remain calm and composed. We must never for a moment yield to impatience and restlessness, for these are always harmful. Far from speeding up our development, they only delay and hinder it. In other words, we must calmly accept whatever we are given or granted and must never force anything. If, for a while, we do not notice any such experiences during sleep, we must simply wait patiently until they appear. This moment will assuredly come. Forcing their appearance may temporarily bring on such experiences, but then they may disappear again completely for longer periods of time. If we remain calm and composed, however, the ability to perceive these things will become our permanent possession. Once this faculty for perception in sleep has been achieved, and sleep experiences stand before our consciousness in complete clarity and vividness, we can then focus our attention on them. We shall find that we are able to distinguish, with some precision, two kinds of experiences. The first is completely different from anything we have ever known. Initially, it delights and uplifts us, but for the moment we should leave it alone. Such experiences, in fact, are the first heralds of a higher spiritual world in which we find our bearings only later. Attentive observation of the second kind of experiences reveals a certain relationship between these and the ordinary world we live in. We find that these experiences illuminate not only our daily reflections, but also the things around us that we have tried to grasp with our ordinary mind but could not. During the day, we think about the world around us. We form mental pictures to try to understand the connections between things. We seek to understand what our senses perceive with the aid of concepts. It is to these mental pictures and concepts that this second kind of sleep experiences refers. Concepts that were previously vague and shadowy now become resonant and alive, much like the sounds and words of the material world. We feel increasingly as though a higher world were softly whispering in our ears answers to the riddles we ponder. We find ourselves able to connect with our everyday life what we receive from the higher world in sleep. Things that we could only think about before now become as vivid and meaningful to us as any sensory experience in the physical world. We realize that the things and beings of this sense-perceptible world are more than what our senses can perceive. They are the expressions and product of a spiritual world whose reality was hidden from us before, but now resounds for us out of our whole environment. It is easy to see that, just as our physical senses are useful for the accurate observation of the world only if they are properly developed and structured, so this higher capacity of perception can benefit us only if the soul's newly opened organs of perception are in good order. As previously indicated, it is we ourselves who produce these higher senses by practicing the exercises that are part of our esoteric schooling. These exercises, of course, consist of concentration and meditation. Concentration means that we focus our attention on particular mental pictures and concepts connected with the mysteries of the cosmos. Meditation means living in such ideas, immersing ourselves in them in accordance with the instructions. Through such concentration and meditation, we work on the soul and develop its organs of perception. Applying ourselves to the tasks of concentration and meditation, we help the soul to grow within the body, just as an embryo does within the mother's womb. The appearance of the isolated experiences that occur in sleep, as previously described, signals the approach of the moment of birth for the soul that has now become free. For by this whole process, the soul has literally become a different being, one we have germinated and brought to maturity within ourselves. Great care must therefore be taken to ensure that we make the right inner efforts in concentration and meditation. The efforts must be precisely observed, for they are the laws governing the germination and development of the higher human soul being. When it is born, this higher being must be a harmonious, properly structured organism. If we neglect to follow the instructions carefully, the result will not be a true living being with its own inherent laws, but a miscarriage on the spiritual plane, incapable of life. Why the birth of this higher soul being must first occur during deep sleep becomes clear when we consider that this delicate and vulnerable organism, lacking all powers of resistance, could not function if it appeared in physical everyday life, for the strenuous, harsh processes of this existence would overwhelm and overpower it. Its activities would be completely overshadowed by those of the body. In sleep, however, when the body and its activities based on sense perception are at rest, the activity of the higher soul, at first so delicate and inconspicuous, can make itself felt. Here again we must bear in mind that we cannot consider these sleep experiences to be fully valid knowledge until we are capable of bringing the newly awakened higher soul across into waking consciousness. Once we can do this, we can perceive the spiritual world in its own character, between and within our everyday experiences. That is, our soul can grasp, as sounds and words, the mysteries of the world around us. It must be understood that at this stage of esoteric training, our experience is limited to spiritual experiences that are isolated and more or less unconnected. Therefore, we must guard against the temptation of using these experiences to construct a closed, systematic edifice of knowledge. Such attempts would only introduce all sorts of fantastic images and ideas into the soul world. We could easily construct a world that has nothing to do with a real spiritual world. Hence, we must exercise the utmost self-discipline at all times. The best thing is to work on achieving greater and greater clarity regarding each experience, while at the same time waiting calmly for new experiences to rise spontaneously and to unite themselves of their own accord with those already known. In other words, we find ourselves experiencing, by means of the force of the spiritual world we have now entered, as well as by our continuing practice of the appropriate exercises, an ever-expanding extension of the consciousness in periods of deep sleep. More and more experiences emerge from the unconsciousness. Our periods of unconscious sleep grow shorter and shorter, and gradually these isolated experiences come together of their own accord, without their real connection being in any way disturbed by such conjectures and conclusions as could derive only from the ordinary mind accustomed to the sense world. Clearly, the less we mix the ways of thinking appropriate to the sense world with these higher experiences, the better. As we follow these guidelines, we draw ever nearer to that stage on the path to higher knowledge at which we can transform previously unconscious states of sleep life into full consciousness. Then we will live in as real a world when our body is asleep as when we are awake. Needless to say, at first the reality we deal with when asleep is different from the sense-perceptible one in which our body lives. Eventually we learn. In fact, we must learn, if we are to keep our feet on the ground and not become fantastic visionaries, how to connect these higher sleep experiences with our ordinary sense-perceptible surroundings. Nevertheless, at first, the world we experience in sleep is a completely new revelation for us. Esoteric or occult science calls the important stage of development wherein we become conscious in sleep, continuity of consciousness. For a person who has reached this stage of development, perception and experience are no longer interrupted by those periods when the body rests, and the soul no longer receives impressions from the senses. Consciousness is unbroken. Chapter 9, The Splitting of the Personality in Esoteric Training. In sleep, the human soul does not receive any information communicated by the physical senses. Perceptions from the ordinary outer world do not reach it. In fact, when we are asleep, our soul is in a sense outside that part of us, the so-called physical body, that mediates sense perceptions and thinking when we are awake. During this time, the soul is connected only with the subtler, ether and astral bodies, both of which elude physical observation. These subtler bodies do not cease their activity in sleep. The soul lives in a higher world, just as the physical body lives among the things and beings of the physical world, where it is affected by them and works upon them. But the soul's life continues during sleep. Indeed, the soul is particularly active then. However, we can know nothing of our activity in this state until we possess the spiritual organs of perception necessary to observe, at least as well as our ordinary senses observe our physical surroundings in daily life, what goes on around us in sleep, and what we ourselves do there. As indicated above, esoteric training consists in the development of such spiritual organs of perception. If our sleep life has been transformed by means of esoteric training along the lines described in the last chapter, then we can follow consciously all that goes on around us in that state. We can, at will, find our way in this new environment as easily as we can in our everyday waking life with our ordinary senses. We must bear in mind, however, that the perception of our ordinary sense-perceptible surroundings already requires a degree of clairvoyance. This was pointed out in the previous chapter. Still, at the beginning of our spiritual development, we perceive things belonging to another world without being able to connect them with our everyday material surroundings. These characteristics of sleep and dream life illustrate what is happening all the time in human beings. The soul lives and acts uninterruptedly in the higher worlds. From these worlds, the soul draws the inspirations and impulses by means of which it works unendingly on the physical body. This higher life remains unconscious in most human beings. But as esoteric students, we bring these higher activities into consciousness. Thereby, our lives are utterly changed. As long as our souls could not see in the higher sense, they were guided by superior cosmic beings. Now they have outgrown this guidance. Just as the operation that enables blind persons to see can change their lives so that they no longer need to be guided by others, so esoteric training likewise changes our lives. As esoteric students, we outgrow the need to be led. From now on, we must lead ourselves. As soon as this happens, of course, we become liable to errors of which ordinary consciousness can have no inkling. We now act out of the world from which, unknown to us before, higher powers once influenced us. These higher powers are regulated by the universal harmony of the cosmos. On the path of inner training, we move out of this cosmic harmony. We must now do by ourselves what was previously done for us without our help or participation. For this reason, esoteric writings often have much to say of the dangers connected with the ascent to higher worlds. These descriptive warnings may easily instill a fear of the higher life in timid souls. Yet it must be said that such dangers exist only if we fail to follow the necessary precautions. As long as we follow fully the advice given by true esoteric training, our ascent to higher worlds will endanger neither life nor limb. even though it will take us through experiences whose power and greatness exceed anything that our wildest sense-bound imagination could conceive of. We encounter terrible powers that threaten life at every turn. We likewise learn to use certain forces and beings imperceptible to our physical senses. The great temptation will be to use these forces for our own selfish, forbidden ends, or to use them incorrectly out of an inadequate knowledge of the higher worlds. Some of these significant experiences, such as the encounter with the guardian of the threshold, will be discussed in later chapters. Nevertheless, whether we are aware of them or not, we must realize that forces hostile to life exist. True, their relationship to us is determined by higher powers, but this relationship naturally changes when we consciously enter into the world previously hidden from us. At the same time, however, our own being is enhanced, and our horizon of life experiences is expanded tremendously. Real danger exists, however, only when impatience and arrogance lead us to assume a certain premature autonomy in regard to our experiences in the higher worlds, when we cannot wait for sufficient insight into the supersensible laws to be given to us. Clearly, in this domain, humility and modesty are far less empty words than they are in ordinary life. But if these qualities have become second nature to us in the best sense, then we can be certain that our ascent to a higher life will be without danger to what we call our life and health. Above all, we must avoid any disharmony between our higher experiences and the events and demands of our everyday life. Our work is wholly here on earth, and if we evade our earthly tasks and try to escape into another world, we can rest assured that we will never achieve our goal. Yet, what our senses perceive is only part of this world. The beings who express themselves in the facts of the physical world are spiritual beings and inhabit the spiritual world. We must achieve and be blessed by the Spirit so that we can introduce its revelations into the sense-perceptible world. In other words, we must transform the earth by implanting in it what we discover of the spiritual realm. Our task is the transformation of the earth. Therein lies the only reason for seeking higher knowledge. The earth, as we know it with our senses, depends on the spiritual world, and this means that we can truly work on the earth only if we share in those worlds where creative forces are concealed. This realization should be our only motivation for wanting to ascend to higher worlds. If we enter esoteric training with this attitude and never deviate from the course it charts for us, we need fear no danger. The prospect of potential dangers on the path of esoteric training should not keep us from following it. It should merely exhort us to work diligently on developing the qualities that every true student of esoteric knowledge should possess. After these introductory comments, intended to dispel any fears, we shall now look more closely at some of these so-called dangers. Great changes definitely occur in the subtler ether and astral bodies of a person who undertakes esoteric training. These changes are connected with certain evolutionary processes taking place in the three fundamental forces of the soul: willing, feeling, and thinking. Before our training, the relationship between these is determined by higher cosmic laws. Nothing about the way we think, feel, or will is arbitrary. Every idea that becomes conscious is connected by natural laws to a particular feeling or act of will. For instance, when we enter a stuffy room, we open the window, or when we hear our name called, we answer the call. Similarly, a foul smell evokes a feeling of disgust in us. These seemingly simple connections between thinking, feeling, and willing are the foundation upon which, if we survey it, we find that our whole life is built. We even consider the interconnectedness of these powers of thinking, feeling, and willing, based as they are on the laws of human nature, to be a prerequisite for a normal life. We would consider a person who took pleasure in foul odors or refused to answer questions as not normal, as violating the laws of human nature. We expect a good upbringing and appropriate instructions to have results because we assume that we can connect a child's feeling, willing, and thinking in a way that corresponds to human nature. Thus, we teach children certain concepts on the assumption that these will later connect with their feelings and will. All such efforts are based on the underlying fact that the midpoints of thinking, feeling, and willing are connected in our finer soul bodies in a definite and lawful manner. This connection in a finer organism of the soul is reflected in the coarser physical body. Here, too, the connection between the organs of will and those of thinking and feeling is determined by laws. This is why a certain thought will regularly evoke a particular feeling or activity of will. In the course of higher development, however, the threads connecting these three basic powers are interrupted, severed. At first, this break occurs only in the subtler soul organism. But later, as we continue our ascent to higher knowledge, the separation also extends into the physical body. In fact, as one develops spiritually, the brain actually separates into three distinct members. Admittedly, this separation is not physically perceptible to the ordinary sense organs and cannot be proven with even the finest physical instruments. Nevertheless, it occurs. Clairvoyants can see that the brain of a person possessing advanced abilities separates into three independently active entities: a thinking brain, a feeling brain, and a willing brain. At this point in our spiritual evolution, the organs of thinking, feeling, and willing function separately, quite independently of one another. Their interconnection is thus no longer regulated by their own inherent laws, but by the individual's awakened higher consciousness. Therefore, one of the first changes we notice in ourselves as we advance in esoteric training is that neither ideas and feelings, nor feelings and decisions, are connected unless we ourselves create the connection between them. No impulse leads us from thought to action unless we ourselves freely create it. Consequently, we can now confront dispassionately events that before our training would have filled us with either burning love or bitter hatred. We can refrain from acting even in the presence of thoughts that would have spurred us automatically to action. Similarly, we can now act solely on the basis of pure will, even though others who have not undergone esoteric training cannot see the slightest reason for engaging in such actions. Thus, the great accomplishment bestowed upon us on this path is the attainment of complete mastery over the interaction of our thinking, feeling, and willing. But such complete mastery over our soul forces also means that we have complete and individual responsibility for them. Not until we have transformed our being in this way can we enter into a conscious relationship with certain supersensible beings and forces. For our soul forces, of thinking, feeling, and willing, are related to specific fundamental forces in the universe. For example, the force inherent in our will can affect certain things and beings of the higher world. It can also perceive them. But it can do so only once it has become free from its connection to feeling and thinking in our soul. As soon as this connection is undone, the activity of the will can be directed outward. The same is true of the powers of thinking and feeling. If someone sends a feeling of hatred toward me, a clairvoyant can see this as a delicate cloud of light of a certain hue, and can ward off this hatred just as we would ward off a physical blow that is aimed at us. Hatred, thus, becomes a perceptible phenomenon in the supersensible world. But we can see it only when we are able to direct the force inherent in our feeling outward, much as we direct the receptivity of our eyes outward into the sense world. And not only hatred, of course, other, more significant facts of the material world are also perceptible in the higher world. And one can enter into a conscious relation with these by discovering and liberating the basic forces of the soul. Unless we follow the instructions of esoteric science closely, such a separation of thinking, feeling, and willing can easily lead us to deviate from the proper human path of development in three ways. Such a deviation occurs when the links connecting the three forces of the soul are destroyed before higher consciousness and its understanding are sufficiently advanced to be able to take the reins and lead the now separated forces in the right way to a free, harmonious working together. The achievement of higher consciousness is necessary because, as a rule, the three forces do not develop equally in every phase of a person's life. In one person, thinking may be more developed than feeling and willing, while in another, feeling or willing may be predominant. As long as the connection between thinking, feeling, and willing remains regulated by the higher laws of the cosmos, however, such developmental discrepancies do not cause any disturbing irregularities in the higher sense. If will predominates in a person, for example, then the cosmic laws ensure that other forces counterbalance it and keep it from becoming excessive. But once we begin esoteric training, then the regulating influence of feeling and thinking on the will ceases, and the will, now no longer held in check, constantly impels us on to tremendous performances of power. If we reach this point before we have mastered higher consciousness and are able to create harmony between our forces, then our will can run rampant. It can overwhelm us so that our feeling and thinking sink into complete powerlessness and we become slaves, scourged by our will. As a result, we can become violent in character, rushing from one unbridled action to the next. We can also go astray if our feeling frees itself from the restraint of higher cosmic laws. A person inclined to revere others, for instance, can then become so completely dependent on them that he or she loses the will and ability to think. Instead of higher knowledge, such a person's lot is the most pitiful inner emptiness and impotence. If the natural tendency of our feeling is toward piety and religious exaltation, on the other hand, we can fall into raptures of religious self-gratification. A third evil arises when thinking predominates. This produces a contemplative nature, but one that is closed in upon itself and hostile to life. For a person of such a nature, the world has meaning only insofar as it provides objects to satisfy a boundless desire for wisdom. Thoughts no longer stir such a person to action or feelings. Instead, such people become indifferent and cold, avoiding contact with ordinary things, as if they were nauseating, or at least had lost all meaning. Thus, there are three ways in which we can go astray and deviate from the proper path of esoteric training. We can fall into willful violence, into sentimental luxuriating in feelings, or into a cold, loveless striving after wisdom. Viewed from the outside, by materialistic psychiatry, for instance, people who go astray in these ways do not seem very different, certainly not in degree, from those who are insane or at least extremely neurotic. Naturally, esoteric training should not lead to such a condition. The important thing is to ensure that thinking, feeling, and willing, the three fundamental forces of the soul, have developed harmoniously before they are freed from the connection implanted in them and become subject to the awakened higher consciousness. If any mistake is made in this development and one of the three basic human forces loses its restraint, then the higher soul's birth into existence will be a miscarriage. When this happens, unrestrained force completely floods our whole personality, and it will be a long time before balance can begin to be restored. Thus, what seems a harmless aspect of our character before we enter esoteric training, such as whether we are predominantly thinking, feeling, or willing types, is so intensified once we become students that it can overpower the universal human element so necessary for life. This only becomes a real danger, however, once we are able to have conscious higher experiences in sleep consciousness as well as in the waking state. As long as our experience of sleep remains at the level of the mere awareness of the intervals in it, our sensory life, regulated by universal cosmic laws, has a compensatory effect on our soul when we are awake, restoring the soul's balance. Hence, it is critically important that our waking life be normal and healthy in all respects. The more fully we can respond to the demands that the outer world places on the healthy, vigorous constitution of the body, soul, and spirit, the better. On the other hand, an overly exciting or exhausting daily life can be harmful because we then add potentially destructive and hindering influences to the great transformations taking place in our inner life. We should deliberately seek out situations for which our strength is adequate and that can bring peace and harmony into our relationship with our surroundings. And we should avoid everything that might disturb this harmony and bring anxiety and turmoil into our lives. Here it is not so much a matter of getting rid of anxiety and turmoil in an outer sense as of taking care that our moods, intentions, and thoughts, as well as our physical health, remain stable and do not constantly fluctuate. All this is not as easy for us after we have begun esoteric training as it was before. The higher experiences that now play into our lives continuously affect our whole existence. If anything is out of order in these higher experiences, then this irregularity lies in wait everywhere and can potentially throw us off at every turn. Therefore, we must do all we can to ensure complete self-mastery. We should never lack presence of mind or fail to survey calmly all situations under our consideration. In fact, any true esoteric schooling itself develops all these qualities in us. In the course of such training, we learn of the dangers and at the same time and at the right moment discover all the power we need to eliminate them from the field.